Yes, and we're on. What's up, everybody? My name is Ian Martin Allison. It's the SBL podcast. You know what it is. You're tuning in. You're checking out this podcast. Usually, it's me and Scott, the Scott and Ian show. However, today, it's just the Ian show because Scott, like a very healthy, balanced individual, is taking vacations. This is a man that takes family vacations. Now, I'm not sure if it's Scott that is orchestrating. Who am I kidding? It is not Scott that's orchestrating these vacations. His wife, Lisa, who I met my last time out in the UK, she's so great. She, I think, is saying to Scott, you need balance. It can't all just be about the bass, dude. It can't all just be about the bass, dude. It's got to be about other things too. It's got to be about family, right? We gotta get in the RV and take the kids and do stuff. And I got to tell you, that's very, very inspirational and sort of convicting to me. I am a bit of a workaholic, I admit. I love doing what I do. I love making content for you. I love playing the bass. I like doing gigs. I like traveling. I like playing gear, you know, all the things, right? This is the life that I love. And then I also love my family, but I struggle. I've talked about this before. I really struggle to make very present family time because I like what I do so much. And that's... It's just a struggle. I know it. At least that's half the battle. It's not like I'm not trying to blame anyone else for it. Like, you know, if my wife is like, hey, we should be hanging out more, spending more time with the kids together. You know, I'm not saying things like, you just don't get it. Can you imagine? You just don't get it. You don't get my passion. I'm not saying that crap. It would make me such an asshole. I'm saying I know and I need to do better. I need to do better. And so, hey, kudos to Scott for getting out on the road today, out on the road with the family. He actually, by the time this pod airs, he might be back. But at the moment, he is on vacation or on holiday, as they say. Bad British accent. I regretted it the instant it came out of my mouth, dude. I regretted it the instant it came out of my mouth. He's on vacation. I'm just going to say it like the American that I am. He's on vacation with his family. You got me. And I have to say, I need to, let me pull up this DM. I got a DM from a guy. I'm on Instagram and I try to get back. You know, I've said before that I get back to everybody on Instagram. Well, I have like a list of a bunch of people, you know, like requests that I haven't dug into. Let me give you a tip. If you send me a DM on Instagram, right? I'm Ian Martin Allison. I'm sorry that I did that to you. Ian Allison was taken. And now people call me Ian Martin Allison, which is so funny to me because, you know, I did it out of necessity and my mom still calls me that when she's pissed at me. So here's the thing. It's Ian Martin Allison on Instagram. Sorry, I'm one of those three-name douchebags. But if you send me a DM, make it short. I don't know. What if you just make it short? What if you make it nice and short? Sometimes when I get ones that are like, if you're not seeing, I'm stretching my fingers real wide as my head. If I have to scroll multiple times, I'm not going to get back to you. Maybe ever, or not at least in the same way that I would if you make it nice and concise and to the point. Is that an asshole thing to say? It's just true for me. It's true. It's a, you know, what's too long didn't read, TLDR. But I want to read it. I just don't always. Check this out. I got a DM, and usually I don't name names, but in this case, I think I'm just going to. It's Victor Pagan on Instagram. So Victor, if you're listening to this, man, thank you so much for this question. You said, dude, I've been meaning to ask you, what's your approach to playing bass at church? I picked up the bass about 2 years ago, but I've played keys for about a decade at church. I immediately got an SBL membership, but I'm finding it a little difficult to apply it in my church context. Non-gospel, Bethel-esque. If you don't know what that means, I'll explain it to you. I think my people would be happy if I play the root and that's it. Any tips? And then he says, thanks for mentioning that you play at church on the podcast and not taking a massive shit on it. Victor, you're welcome. And thank you. And then we go on to chat a little bit, but it really made me think about this. I've been wanting to do an episode. I've alluded to this in other episodes where I've talked about there's two worlds that seem to be disparaged, or in Victor's words, shit on. I think I've said that too, right? But there's two worlds in music where that happens. It's in like event band space where you're either playing at weddings or parties or cover bands, right? Or whatever that is. And Scott and I even did an episode where we talked about maybe the perceptions on that are changing. Could just be sort of a generational thing. When I came up, like the thing was to like get into a band and play like real music, like your own original music. And if you went too long playing covers, like how I grew up anyway, or at least in my friend group, it was not cool. It was not cool. And then the same too was true for me with church. People would refer to it as like church gigs, or like, I gotta wake up early from a church gig. Terrible. Oh, they don't even let me smoke at the church gig. You know, that's so dumb. No one has actually ever said that sentence to me. But you know what I'm saying? You hear people talk that way, or like, oh yeah, I gotta go play a wedding, you know, brown eyed girl, and you know, like, don't stop believing. You know, all that, right? You hear people disparage those types of gigs, or at least I do. I have had that in my life. And I've kind of, like, in some ways, I totally understand it. I understand that the pinnacle is getting into a great band and having success, or being a side musician and touring with a great artist and, right, some kind of creative endeavor that makes you feel really fulfilled. But that's not always the reality for everybody, right? And not everybody wants that. If you're honest, not everybody wants to be slogging it out in a van with a band until you get huge or not, right? Not everybody wants that life. Some people want to play at the coffee shop. Some people want to play at weddings. Some people just play in church. And I don't mean just, I should have used the word only. Some people only play in church. And some of those musicians in all of those spheres are super legit and incredible, right? So I think I said at one point, I don't want to be the guy that like plants the flag for like the cover band musician or the church musician. But this, you know what? Today on the podcast, I'm planting the flag. Okay. I want to tell you about both of those environments, which I know really well, at least in my town in Minneapolis, where I live. I moved from Montana to Minneapolis. I've pretty much made all of my music professionally in the city of Minneapolis, which has two very strong scenes, a very strong, like, evangelical church scene, and I'll explain what that means in a moment, and also a very strong cover band or like event band scene. And I have done a lot of both of those things, and I have to say, I have loved them. And I've been sort of surprised by how much I've loved them. And I haven't loved every aspect of them, right? But I have really enjoyed so many of the gigs, opportunities that have stemmed from it by meeting the people in those spaces. So here's the thing. If you're in any of those spaces, either of those spaces right now, or something similar, or you're playing cruise ships, or something that's sort of adjacent to the things I'm talking about today, hopefully this will give you some perspective of my experiences with it, and it'll hopefully give you a framework for your own experiences. Or if you've never checked it out, I wonder if this is maybe the push you need to like join a cover band, or check out, or like audition for that church, right? There's so many ways you can play the bass guitar or play an instrument. And hey, maybe you're not a bass player listening to this. I assume you are, right? But maybe you're not. There's just so many ways that you can do music, right? And these two spaces are really fruitful in a lot of ways. And I want to talk about them. And also some caveats and some horror stories and some pitfalls and all the things. But hey, let me start with this. I think that playing in a cover band is one of the best things that you can possibly do for your playing. It is one of the best things you can possibly do for your playing because of the variety. Typically, When you get on a gig like that, there's so much variety. You're playing all kinds of different styles. You have to dial up different sounds. You're moving your hands around. Maybe you're playing with a pick. You're stepping on pedals to emulate certain grooves from, you know, all the way from like maybe the jazz set that you do, right? The dinner hour, all the way like to the banging, like top 40 dance hit music that you play near the end of the reception, right? So I'm talking about a wedding band. But also this applies too to playing covers at a bar. Maybe you're in the burbs and you're playing country music covers in the United States. You're probably not doing that anywhere else in the world, right? But I'm sure every country has sort of that vibe, right? Where you're playing a certain kind of folk music, right, in the city or outside of the city. And in America, the folk music that happens really outside of the city in like rural America is American country music, sort of modern American country music. And I think that those musicians sometimes embody the stereotypes of like, oh, you know, they're tired and they don't care anymore and they're going through the motions. But boy, I haven't had that be the case. In a lot of the bands that I've played in cover bands, musicians have been pretty engaged and pretty damn good too. And now occasionally you get in a band where, you know, you all start playing Sweet Home Alabama or something and people are making wrist-slitting motions, right? But I haven't had that very often. I play in a band in Minneapolis called The Covers. Oh, God. I play in a band in Minneapolis that's like a cover band and event and wedding band, and it's called The Covers. Now, is it the worst band name of all time? Yes. Yes. Is there a worse band name out there that has ever... No. Is The Covers the worst band name that you... Yes, but is it full of incredible musicians that really care and show up and crush every single gig? Also, yes. I have frequently said that I will play any song any amount of times if the band and the band members are into it and giving of themselves to it. Now, obviously, there's songs that come up that I'm like, ooh, played this one a lot. But if I ever start to feel that, I try to dig into the minutiae. Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison. Oh, God. I do remember saying to Steve Jenkins in a podcast that I did during COVID, if I just get to play Brown Eyed Girl at a wedding again, I'll be happy. Because I thought that, like, music was never coming back. And then, you know, now I've played enough gigs, right, where I'm like, oh boy, I sort of wish I hadn't said that. But here's the thing. If I ever find myself feeling despondent or uninspired or like, ooh, this is, I've been doing this a lot, right? I try to dig into the minutiae. In the moment, there's really only two things you can do, right? You can decide to just give into that and start to play stupid licks and try to make it like, quote unquote, more interesting for yourself. And I think that's dubious at best. I think the best thing to do is to like try to make it more simple, almost. Play super tight. Like, notice, like, are you playing really nice and locked in with the drums? Notice your note lengths, your cutoffs. Instead of trying to play more fills, I think the secret to combating boredom is playing less. I'm gonna say that again, like we're in school. I think the secret to combating boredom on the gig is actually playing less. It takes more effort to play less, right? To cut off notes in a different way, to leave a bar open, right? Like to drop out in kind of a cool space that makes the band kind of take notice and, you know, it's sort of disruptive, but in a cool way, instead of more fills, more ideas, more slapping, more tapping. What if we play less? That's how I try to combat boredom on the bandstand when I'm regretting that I said, if I could only play Brown Eyed Girl again, right? on the Steve Jenkins, what is it, like Artists in Quarantine? What was it called? Oh, he has such a cool podcast, and now I'm forgetting what it's called. Good job, Ian. Yeah, good job, Ian. Well done. Come on, dude. What's it called? It's called... I can't remember, but he had a cool tag where he said, like, you know, artists and creatives during the quarantine. Oh, damn it, Steve Jenkins. Sorry, I can't remember the name of your podcast off the top of my head, even though I did an episode. Shit! It's really good, though. Check out Steve Jenkins' podcast. It's going to come to me in the episode. I'm not going to even edit around it. It's going to come to me, and that's going to feel great. And I hope now that that's true. So what I care about in the space of the event band is that everyone gives a shit. I have to be playing with people that care. I have to be playing with people that care. A great example of when it went the wrong way is I played with a dueling piano trio. It was during COVID, went outside of the city, right? And it was as if COVID didn't, it was right in the height of so many people getting COVID and people dying. And, you know, you get into a little bit like outside of a metro in the US and it was like, COVID didn't exist. I mean, people didn't care at all. And that was a weird vibe. That was a weird vibe because I was trying to do my part. I was masking up. I was social distancing and I was the weirdo, right? So I'm in that zone, but we're playing outside and that's cool. And we're playing outside and it's a good time. I'm having fun. But then they're calling a bunch of songs that weren't on my list, right? And I don't really know them. So now I'm playing a lot of mistakes and I'm feeling kind of shitty about that. And then I realized after a while that like, it doesn't really matter. Like the people that are there at this event, I think it was a wedding. Yeah, it was a wedding, but they didn't really care about the band. And that's true of a lot of weddings. You're not the centerpiece, right? You're like the backdrop for a good time. But this one was even more so in that way. And it felt like I could have just played everything a half step up. And it wouldn't have mattered. And that was a terrible feeling. Like, even for me, I mean, like, I would make a couple mistakes and go, oh, and like, look over at the guitar player and the drummer, and they're like, don't worry about it. You know, we're just having fun. I'm like, okay, yeah, can I get into the spirit of that? We're just having fun. We're just having fun. But I wasn't having fun. We're supposed to be, yeah, we're supposed to be having fun. They're saying, like, don't worry about it because we're having fun. We're just supposed to be having fun. But I'm not. I am not having fun. I'm like, why is that? And at the end of the gig, the guitar player, who's awesome guitar player, and I've played with him in a bunch of stuff, he's amazing, came up to me and said, man, isn't it fun to have a gig where nothing matters? And I said, no. He was like, man, isn't it just awesome to like do a gig where like it kind of really doesn't just matter. You're getting paid to just sort of like whatever, and you're trying stuff, and there's no consequence really. It doesn't matter. And I was like, no, boy, for me, I sort of wish in a way that I had that. I wish I could go into that headspace, but it's so damn meaningful to me, probably to a fault. It means so much. I want to do a good job. I don't like, oh my God, you're playing the bass. You're a bass player. All you have to do is play one note in the right place. You don't have to worry about the chord quality. If it says G, and then there's a bunch of shit after the G, a minus sign, or a triangle, or a 7, or a B5, you don't have to do any of that. You know what? You can just play a G. How about that? You can just play a G. It is, at its function, the most simple instrument to play. Now, don't hear me saying that it's easy. I'm just saying that our job description is fairly simple. We're supposed to play a root note with nice low end and sound in the right place. That is really all that most people ask of us. And I feel like when I can't accomplish that simple task out of just I'm making a mistake, lack of preparation, band leader calls a song I don't know, then it's not on me. But I want to hold myself accountable, right? I want to be prepared. I try to prepare, try to memorize, I try to show up and crush it. And when I play a quote unquote wrong note, I don't think that that's no big deal. Like, I'm like, oh my God, I had one job. You know, like, imagine being a receiver, right, in the NFL, the bomb down the field, and it's a perfectly thrown ball, and you're like, yep, got it, and it bounces out of your hands. I bet receivers are just like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm a professional. Like, I'm a professional. I need to play the right note at the right time. So I have that outlook, right? And so when someone says, isn't it great to have a gig where it doesn't matter? My answer is emphatically no. No, because I want to do a good job. Like, it's the only thing I can do. Right? Like, it's the only thing I'm kind of good at. Like, playing a G where the G is supposed to go. And if I accidentally play a C sharp where that G is supposed to go, well, shit! I don't want to do that. It matters to me, right? So what I learned at that gig is that it is very, very meaningful. It's very meaningful to me to be with players that also share that same thing. Where, like, if we screw up a section, we're going to talk about it on set break. Where, like, if somebody is always doing a change that the rest of the band isn't reflecting, we're going to let them know. We want to be together. We want to be good. We want it to be fun. Hey, something else is that the time that you are on stage is the reward for all of your hard work. Once again, for the people in the back, the time that you are on stage is the reward for all of the time and effort and sweat and tears and blood and calluses and time away from friends, right? And time away from family, right? Learning how to speak the language of music. Your time on stage is the reward. If you shortchange that reward by not practicing, by not preparing, by not memorizing, by being a terrible reader, that's an indictment on me, you are shortchanging yourself of the reward. Like, why do we even do this, right? It's to have fun, I think. So when you get up on stage, that's supposed to be fun. That's not supposed to be drudgery. So why do I still see people in cover bands that are looking at music who've been playing in that band for 10 years and they're still looking at the book? Memorize your songs. Memorize your songs. If this is speaking to you right now, good. Now, that said, let me just say this. I will go on a tear about this at a gig. Like, you guys, we got to get off book. I'm the one that's always saying, guys, come on, we can do it. We got to get off book. Singers, there's nothing worse than seeing a band and all the singers are looking at a lyric book. No. For karaoke, yes. For a live band, no. Get off of the book, right? And it's easy to do. You just have to put it away and then spend some time playing the songs without looking at the charts. Now, there was a gig that I was like, you guys, we got to get off book. We got to do it. We got to do it. We're all memorized. Come on. Come on. Everyone's like, I don't know. And then the band leader called a song. So I had, like, put all my stuff away. I have, like, a stupid iPad on a stupid stand. I hate the way that looks so much. Oh, I hate it so much. It's probably aesthetically, I'm aesthetically motivated. And it's probably part of the reason I want to memorize, because I hate, like, looking at an iPad on a stupid stand on a stupid microphone. Like, oh God, I hate that. So just for me, for you, you might love it, and that's fine. But for me, I hate it. I hate the way it looks. It'll look, and the light is shining on your face. And dude, oh, I hate it so much. So I had put mine away. I'm like, I'm doing the whole gig, right? I memorized. I'm all good. There are a few that I needed, but not anymore, you guys, because I prepared and I'm all set, right? And then the band leader was like, Sweet Love by Anita Baker. And I was like, oh, dear God. Sheepishly, and my eyes got wide and everyone just died laughing. And I, like, saunter over to Alex, who was playing guitar. Shout out to you, Alex, dude, that you saved my bacon, dude, that night. I, like, saunter over. I'm like, bro. And he's like, yeah, all right, buddy. Come on over to my chart, to my lovely chart. Oh, and so, of course, it bites you in the ass occasionally. But I really want to endeavor to know this music. Anytime I play with somebody, I want to know those songs. I don't want to be constantly looking at charts. Now, if there's a few notes that you need, that's fine. A set list with some notes. But that's one thing I want to say to you today on the old SBL podcast. Is this the year of you getting off of charts? I don't know. I can't answer that for you, but I'm going to ask it again. Is this the year that you get off charts? For the band that you've been playing in for 5 years, dude. The band that you've been playing in for eight. You mean to tell me that you've been playing in this band for 13 years and you're still looking at the freaking book, dude? No, No, it's time. It's time because we're endeavoring to play well. We're endeavoring to care. We're endeavoring to memorize. And when you do, then you're able to have fun. And guess what? At that point, you do not shortchange yourself. You do not rob yourself of the reward. The reward is playing music on stage, live, with nice sounding in-ears, with a cool sounding amp, whatever, with your pedal board, with your bass, that you just put these new strings on that you love and you're excited to try them out on a gig. The gig is the reward. Make sure that you're doing everything possible to make that an enjoyable, fun experience. It has mostly to do with preparation. It has mostly to do with preparation. Here's the thing. Before I close up this segment on cover bands, I want to make a pitch to you. I want to tell you that I think it's one of the spaces where you grow the most. There are so many different songs and styles and sounds that you have to do that if you join a band like that and you take it really seriously, it will grow your playing by leaps and bounds. You're going to learn so much. You're going to learn all this music. You're going to learn how to go from song to song quickly because the drummer's going to count stuff off faster than you're ready for because you're flipping through your freaking book, right? You're going to have a amp die on stage and have to figure it out and plug into a DI and get it through a tiny little 8-inch wedge monitor for the rest of the night and hate your life and then wonder why you brought that esoteric tube amp on the gig, right? Just that happened to me, right? Right. All of these things battle harden you. It battle hardens you. It makes you so much more impervious to folly, to failure. It makes you so much better at all kinds of music. You got to walk a ballad in the first set. You've got to play with a pick and play Shut Up and Dance. Shout out to Walk the Moon. I'm the guy, you guys, I'm the guy in the wedding band that's like, have you checked out the other songs from Walk the Moon? Have you checked out Kamikaze? Do you enjoy One Foot in front of the other? I do. I love Walk the Moon, right? So I love getting to play these songs. I absolutely love it because it gives context to all the things that you do. It rounds you out so much. It's amazing. Quick anecdote, too, about this before we move on. I had an opportunity to sub for the great Nick Salisbury. Nick Salisbury is an incredible bass player. If you wouldn't mind, go check out Ashley Still. Ashley Still and Nick Salisbury's record, Firefly. They did a record that is just bass and voice, and it was absolutely super influential, way ahead of its time. Big influence on me doing the bass voice duo stuff that I do. Incredible. Nick Salisbury is amazing. Session bass player in Minneapolis. He calls me and he's like, hey, dude, will you sub with this band called The Irresistibles? And I was like, maybe. Yeah, I was mid-20s, 26. He was like, here's the deal. It's a lot of songs. It's like 70 songs, but they're all in a book you wouldn't have to memorize because you're just subbing in at one time. And the money's not great either. I'm like, oh, okay, 70 songs. He's like, yeah. And I was like, and what's the money? And he's like, it's $100. And I said, oh. And he said, but it's really a great band, a great band leader. Shout out to the legendary Mick Sterling. Mick Sterling is a saint, an incredible singer, incredible man in Minneapolis, been working so hard his whole life, putting on great shows. It was Mick Sterling's band. Nick says to me, it's Mick's band, it's really fun, and it's kind of a lot of like R&B, some kind of cool deep cut stuff, and really good songs. And I said, yeah, okay. And I think you could tell that I was like about to say no. And he said, hey, let me ask you this. He's like, look, I know it's a lot of songs and I know it's not a lot of money, but let me ask you this. How well do you know this material? How well do you know how to play like R&B, Motown, like style, like Stax, soul, R&B, Motown style bass playing? And I said, not very well. And he said, well, check it out. If you studied with me or you studied with a bass player, what do you think they would have you do? And I said, oh no, I know where this is going. Learn songs. And he's like, Yeah. You probably learn some scales. You probably learn some chord tones. And then they would have you apply that to songs. And then he said, no. Now check this out. In that transaction, would you be paid? and I said, no. And he said, right, you'd pay to learn the songs. So what if you thought about this as like you're essentially going through a crash course in this genre that you don't know very well, and instead of paying for it, you will be paid to learn it. And I thought that that was some of the best advice that I had ever been given in my life. So I want to say the same thing to you. Now, obviously, I'm not saying to you, say yes to everything. Say yes to at the cost of your health, at the cost of your family. No, it's about happiness, right? But if you're young, if you're striving, if you want to get in, you want to get better, one of the best things that you can do is to say yes to a band that's going to make you learn 70 songs. I worked my ass off for that gig. And then guess what? I got to do it a bunch. I got to play a bunch with that band. And then I met a bunch of people from that band that made other bands. And I played with those people. And then they had other bands. And right? Like, it just has legs. If you prepare for that gig, even though it's just $100, if you prepare for that gig like it's $10,000, like it's the most important thing that you've ever done in your life, what happens is people see that and then you get 1,000 other opportunities making more money, playing cooler songs or playing, you know, other cool songs, I should say, because that set list was insane. It was so good. I was playing all this Amy Winehouse music. I was playing like deep cut Robert Palmer tunes that were so dope. Sly and the Family Stone tunes, like Marvin Gaye, right? Donny Hathaway. That was not stuff in my 20s that I was playing in my like original rock band. So if you find yourself wondering, what can I do to get better? How can I branch out? I'm in a rut. There's so many things that you can do to address that. But one thing is, if you're not already involved in some kind of event band space, get involved. Get involved. You won't believe how much it will grow you. Now, obviously, there's a other side to the coin. Obviously, right? Like, if that's all you do, this is just like anything, though. If it's all you do, yeah, you can get burned out. Yeah, do you want to play Don't Stop Believin' at the end of the night for the rest of your life? Probably you don't, right? But do it for a little while and then do something else. It's going to grow you so much. So I hope... And two, like, just know that I have such respect for people that do that and do it really well. So, like, cover musicians, people that play in event bands are some of the most badass musicians out there. They are, right? And now, listen, if that's you and you're like, oh yeah, but I'm so burned out on it, then you need to do the opposite. Then you need to prioritize something that isn't your cover band. You need to jump out of that space a little bit. Take a weekend off, sub a weekend out, and book a day at a studio with your friends and jam and see what happens. Make a side project, right? Or record some content for the internet where you're talking about a pedal that you like or a bass or playing a song or like whatever it is that you like and you feel like you're yearning for that. Take a weekend off. This is a prescription for you. If you're in the cover band space and you're burnt out, take a weekend off. Oh no, you're going to lose $600. No, I'm sorry. I don't mean that. Like, maybe you need that $600, right? But is there a way that you can carve a bit of time and maybe it's a touch of a sacrifice? What if it's just one night? Or what if it's a day? What if you take a Saturday off and you get together with your friends and you spend a little money and you invest in yourself? You double down on you. You play in a studio, you play some riffs that you've been working on for a few years, right? That have been on your phone forever. And you make a side project. That is how to stay inspired if you're stuck in a rut in the cover band thing. Now, that's going to apply to this next thing I want to talk to you about as well, which is I've got a nose tickle. I got a nose tickle, you guys. Whew. We're not going to edit that out. We keeps it real. It keeps it real, the SBL podcast. I also want to say church. Terrible segue. Church, you guys, church. You know what I'm saying? Church. So I started out, you know, I read that question from Victor, who's talking about church music space, and I started out in cover band space, but a lot of this applies to church as well. And I can tell you from experience, from deep experience in like worship music world, that it is that I have met some of the most amazing people, amazing musicians, had incredible experiences. Even despite all of my misgivings, maybe about political motivations, about the church, about, you know, about the culture, about certain belief systems, I've struggled with those things. And then I thought, oh, these people are going to be terrible. And because, you know, we don't see eye to eye. We don't vote the same. And then I have had lovely experiences with the people in that environment. Lovely. Shockingly lovely to me. I was born in a small town in Montana. I was born in a small town. I promise I'll make this brief. There was an evangelical church on the hill. Now, if you're not from the United States, and you might be saying, like, what is an evangelical church? I don't really know, but it's a church where there's maybe some loud music, maybe hands go up in the air, maybe they're speaking in tongues. They're very conservative, but they're also having a good time. And my parents thought it was the wackiest shit ever. My mom and maybe dad, there was like a Assemblies of God church on this hill next to where I grew up, and they called it God Incorporated. We would laugh and snicker and point at it when we drove by. And I remember that I had friends that went to that church, and my mom's amazing, but my mom was like not that cool with me going to that church. In fact, or even like listening to Christian music. I had friends that loved like DC Talk, like Jars of Clay, right? And she was like, I would rather you be listening to Sly Stone and like Metallica and the Beatles and Zeppelin and Van Halen. That's like real music, and that is of the world, and it's not this whippy, like crazy whippy end of the branch like Christian music. So while my friends in youth group were like burning their Green Day CDs, my mom was like, no Stephen Curtis Chapman in this house. And it's so wild. So like I grew up in the Episcopal Church, which is sort of, if you don't know what that is, it's like the tradition and trappings of Catholic Mass, but in a very liberal space, right? Gay bishops, very, like super inclusive, tackling issues that the Catholic Church wouldn't want to tackle or the Evangelical Church wouldn't want to tackle with a 10-foot pole. And that's just how I grew up, right? And then I had an opportunity to teach at a college called North Central University in Minneapolis. I was working at a music store. The music store gig ended. Mars Music, the whole chain folded. And I had an opportunity. It was like, oh, change of career time. Right? I was playing in an original band, loving that, but I needed to make some money. Wasn't really hip to doing the cover band thing yet, right? Because I was dead focused on my original band. And I was writing down things that I could do. Like, I wonder, I like it. And one of the things I wrote down was vending machine guy. And thankfully, my dear friend Matt Kirkwald, who at the time worked at this little Christian school in Minneapolis, said, this school needs a bass teacher desperately. And I applied to this school. And now North Central University, still operating, still doing just fine in downtown Minneapolis. It is an Assemblies of God college. And Assemblies of God, I don't know too much about the denomination, but I do know that it is charismatic and conservative, very conservative. And there was this thing that everyone had to sign if you worked there or went there, like a lifestyle, like code of conduct thing. And, you know, one of the things was you couldn't drink, which just blew my mind. And the funny thing was, I don't drink. I'll never forget Herb Johnson, Dr. Johnson. Shout out to Dr. Johnson. Was interviewing me for the gig, and I think they had had somebody, they had interviewed someone for the gig who, like, you know, they tried to make them sign this lifestyle contract, and the person was like, this is not biblical, this has nothing to do with Jesus, this, you know, right, and had this huge, threw this big fit, and they're like, you know, and so they're, so Dr. Johnson, who's interviewing me, says, okay, Ian, yeah, boy, you sure seem like a great candidate for this job. Can I ask you, what is your relationship with alcohol? And I said, oh, I don't drink. And he was like, you're hired. I mean, not really, but right. So the funny thing was, right, this church, a college, but a Christian college. I went into this space thinking, oh man, there's this lifestyle contract that's so weird. Oh, it's a denomination that my parents really like slagged on when I was a kid. It's going to be full of crazy people and just, and they're not the same politically, and they're right. And then what did I find? Pretty much went to a person that everyone was lovely. So many people in that space, or in other spaces, in spaces that you know, that you are not familiar with. They're trying to do the thing that they think is the right thing. Maybe you don't think it's the right thing, but they think it's the right thing, right? And they're going to do that thing. And instead of thinking that they're evil and insane and crazy and horrible, and what if you meet them? What if they're struggling with it too? What if they were raised in a home that was very conservative, and that's the place, that was their only option to go to college, and they're kind of towing the line, but they have a lot of questions about it? What if you talk to those people? What if they help you see a certain side and you help them see a certain side? What if you become really good friends? Right? These are all things that happened to me as a base teacher at North Central University for 10 years. I was there for 10 years. As a result of that job that I was really sort of scared of in the beginning, because I felt like I was, you know, like my mom was like, oh no, you're going to work for the cult. I mean, you know, and some people would say it is a cult. Some people would say, oh yeah, that's a cult. But what isn't a cult? Right? I mean, like, what I discovered without going too far down that road was a lot of really well-intentioned, amazing people that I bonded with, and I was surprised. And so many opportunities came out of that. One opportunity was playing worship music in the church. Now, again, if you're not from America, it's so wild. Like, the evangelical rock and roll sort of like Coldplay megachurch thing doesn't exist as intensely in other places like the UK. The Hillsong model, the Bethel model of like a big, huge multi-site megachurch where there's a stage and lights and smoke and big screens and incredible production and stand in this mark because the light cue and the words on the back of the screen and right, like that scene is thriving in America, for better or for worse, depending on who you ask. Okay? Depending on who you ask, for better or for worse. And now I want to make a very clear distinction. When I talk about playing in church, for me, it was not in the American Black Gospel Church. So like Michael League, for instance, went to school at North Texas and spent some time in Dallas playing in Black Gospel churches, like American Black Gospel Church. And that scene could not be farther away from the evangelical, like rock and roll megachurch vibe. Not to say that there aren't different races in either side, but the gospel church really thrives on, like, not so much improvisation, but on, there is a value in going for it. Like in bass playing, like you see gospel bass players playing a lot of notes, playing fills, slapping. Like there is this exuberant expression that comes out of that scene. And it's not just wanking, it's within confines, and you have to know how to play it well. And the gospel players are monsters, like Andrew Goucher, Sheree Reed, monster players. But it is such a different aesthetic and value than the rock and roll evangelical megachurch. And that value is restraint. There's a value on don't distract. So we're going to put on this beautifully timed, orchestrated sounding show, essentially, to present an atmosphere and sound and vibe and space for people to sing collectively in a room and experience what they think is the presence of God. And I'm not saying that with any, I'm not saying what they think. I'm not looking down at my nose, but there is a vibe there where it's like, we're here for a reason. The reason is to create an experience for people to come together and sing and declare things with one another that make them feel closer to a spiritual presence. That spiritual presence in the American evangelical megachurch being Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Right? And again, the black church, like the black gospel church, is similar. Like, they're creating an environment. It's just a different environment. It's, they don't have the same ideas of distraction that the like rock church does. Distraction, like if someone played a huge giant fill in the rock and roll Bethel Hillsong style church, that would be seen as like, ooh, oh, you're maybe shining too much of a light on yourself and your own ego and your own ability, and that's going to distract people from looking up, and they're going to look at you, and that's seen, for better or for worse, as a bad thing, or as a thing that you don't do. It's just not, it's not part of the vibe. Whereas in the American Black Gospel Church, drawing attention is how you praise. Pretty cool. Both of them have valid points. But I just want to tell you that the time that I spent, and still in some ways do spend, I play at one church less and less now, but called Upper Room in Minneapolis. And I've been there for a long time, and my family goes, we love it. And it's incredible. And it is not an evangelical church. It's a very liberal, it's a very liberal church, actually. But the time that I have spent in like rock and roll evangelical megachurch has taught me so much. And so many people disparage it. You hear people talking about, oh, my church gig, or like, oh, the songs are so easy, or the songs are so boring, or oh, they just want me to play root notes. And, you know, contrast that with the gospel church where, wow, I mean, you know, you can play a lot and get claps for trying to go crazy on the instrument. And that, you know, has diminishing returns too. You still have to play song forms but there's this vibe in that evangelical rock and roll church of like, play the root note, play what's on the record, and don't distract the room. And sometimes that's seen by a lot of people as like a negative thing or as boring, right? And I'm here to tell you that if you just decide that it's a thing, it doesn't have to be your thing that you always do, but if you just decide that that's a thing and it's valid, just like if you played a jazz brunch, you're going to play walking bass lines, and you're probably not going to be like, oh, these walking bass lines are so stupid and like boring. I mean, maybe you feel that way, but it's the thing that you do for that genre of music. What I'm saying is, I encourage you, if you're doing it and you're bored, or if you have wondered about doing it, I'm encouraging you to just like embrace what it is. And what it is playing very simply with incredible, impeccable gridlock time feel, with incredible tone, right? And incredible attention to detail around attack, evenness, cutoff, sound, all of those things, playing the perfect whole note that fills that auditorium with low end in the bridge, right? And then going to a slow driving quarter note that breaks into a slow driving eighth note that breaks into a 16th note thing before the release into the last chorus. That stuff you don't get anywhere else. So just like the cover scene, playing in church, it's a thing. It's such a thing. When I started doing it, I was like so many people that didn't grow up in that. I thought it was dumb. I thought it was dumb and stupid and simple, and I needed the money, and I liked the people. I did not like the music, but I really liked the people, and I liked that I got paid. So in the gig triangle, remember, the gig triangle, you have compensation, hang, relationship, and the quality of music, if you like the music. I had 2 out of 3, and as Meatloaf would say, y'all, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, right? So I was happy to do it because I had 2 out of 3, but check it out. The longer I did it, the more I started to realize, oh, restraint is the value here. It's not playing big fills. It's not always trying to do something flashy. It's not thinking, oh, the bass player probably sucks in this band, so I'm going to show them how. I mean, what? I actually thought that in my 20s, that like, oh, the players that play on these records are terrible, and so I'm really going to do something cool. That is the most naive, shitty thing to think. It is not true. The players that play, like right now, after this podcast, go check out David Curran. David Curran is a bad motherfucker on the bass. And excuse my French, David Curran, if you ever hear this, dude, you are so great. Killing bass player that plays for, I believe he's played for Kerry Job, plays for so many artists. I wish I could rattle him off, but I don't have him in front. He makes HX preset, like, presets for the stomp. He's so well versed in that contemporary Christian world. He plays so beautifully. He's a killer player, and it is an art form, right? Check out David Curran. And you're just going to see, like, if you dive into this world, don't think about it as, roll your eyes, it's a church gig, lame, everything's so easy. Is it? If you hear a board tape back, do you like how you sound? Right? Maybe you do. But boy, it is so difficult to play that music well. That's why you hear a lot of bad church bands. It's really difficult music to play well. Like, to really make it sound powerful and dynamic with the right tiers of build in the bridge, it's so difficult. It's so difficult to sing it well. So the worship leaders are killers. Like, I mean, shout out to like Chris Mason at Eaglebrook Church, Emily Alexander at Eaglebrook Church, Josh Clutter at Eaglebrook Church, Dave Holvig. There's so many people that I'm not saying. Those are the worship leaders that came to my mind, though, right? And if you don't know, a worship leader is the lead singer. Worship leader is somebody that leads. They're spinning so many plates. They're leading the congregation in this experience. They're also leading the band, sometimes with hand signals. Shout out Mark Allen at Eaglebrook Church. Eaglebrook Church is a big, I've said it now a lot, I might as well tell you. Eaglebrook Church is a giant multi-site mega church in Minneapolis. And it gets a lot of heat. Like, it takes a lot of flack for being what it is, which is a big multi-site megachurch. But it also, it gets a lot of love for what it does. And what it does is it employs hundreds of musicians. Hundreds. And if you think back to when the Catholic Church was buying music, or essentially, you know, paying Mozart to compose, you can think about the modern church as doing the same thing. You're paying musicians to come in and supply an environment, a musical environment, for people to experience a collective spiritual experience. I hate that I said experience twice there, but I did. We're going to live with it. Yeah, we're going to live with it. That's what the church is doing, right? And as a byproduct of that, it funds this whole other thing, which is all the indie music that's being made in Minneapolis. So much of it is church funded, not directly, hear what I'm saying, indirectly, right? So there are so many friends of mine that just make their living playing in the church. And I think that that's cool. I think that you learn so much. You have to memorize the music. You have to show up, wear in-ear monitors, and mix the whole set of music by yourself on a thing. You're like, oh, wow, I have 16 channels. There's two guitars. I can pan them and EQ them. There's tracks that I'm playing with, a click, all these things. I'm supposed to stand in this spot because that's where the light is hitting me the best. Oh, careful, because when the person is speaking or there's a moment where they're doing a Bible verse, let's step out of the way so that, people can read the screen. There's so many things. I mean, the biggest thing for me, I was an MD, musical director, at Eagle Brook Church for a long time. I learned how to use Ableton. I learned how to use tracks. I really got my click playing together. I was in the scene when there was a bunch of sort of like electronic music happening in the church. That's how I dialed in a ton of my synth sounds. I mean, I'm going to say it. Like, I don't think that I would be playing all the synth-based stuff that I'm doing now on a bunch of people's records without the modern evangelical megachurch experience in my life. I know that I wouldn't. Because I had an avenue to explore that stuff. The time that I was there, it was really cool time where we were just starting to integrate like Ableton and tracks and click and counts and, synth-based sounds. And I didn't view that as like stupid. Oh, stupid. We're going to play with tracks. Oh, I can't. The click ruins my groove. Like all that like immature crap that people say. No, I saw it as an opportunity to grow. Like, when are you ever going to play with tracks? Unless you're in Miley Cyrus's band or at a big mega church, right? So get that experience, right? Also, like having to show up really early, having to hang out in a green room and eat weird snacks and talk to people that you may not share the same worldviews. That's actually good for you. I think it was really good for me. It was incredibly good for me. And I miss it in a way too, I miss it. So now if you're thinking to yourself, there's no way I would ever go play at a church for like personal reasons, political reasons, ethical reasons, don't hear me say, oh, that stuff doesn't matter. Of course that matters. Everybody's got different ways they feel. But it's so funny. I came home from something one time where, a pastor at a church said something that really rubbed me the wrong way. And I was crabbing and telling my wife, Emily, like, I'm going to get out of here. Like, this sucks. And she was like, hey, just, you can do anything you want. But just know that like where I work, not everybody is like a bleeding heart liberal like we are. Where I work, there are people that have different opinions and we have to work together. I was like, oh yeah. Right? So I don't know. I think that I was really in a bubble. And then I really had an experience, a positive experience in that environment that I was not expecting. And it changed my life. I think for the better. It really changed my life. And listen, don't hear me saying that it's perfect and amazing. There's things about the church that are terrible. Like they call money honorarium, right? And like talking about money in the church can be so difficult. Shout out to Eagle Brook Church and Upper Room though, for not making money weird and not calling it honorarium. But there is there's a reason why people have arm's length vibes about playing a church. There are aspects of it that are weird if you didn't grow up in it. There are. But you know what? Still do it. Still do it. If you want to do it, I've gotten a bunch of DMs from people that are like, oh, how do you feel about playing a church if like you're not a believer and they want you to be a believer? I think that stuff... What do I want to say about this? I've gotten that question a few times. I think you're at the wrong church then. I think if a church is confident in its leadership, maybe I'll just leave it at that. If there is strong leadership at a church, probably they're not going to make you take a Jesus quiz. They're not going to be like, talk to me about, how much you know about the Bible. Tell me about your relationship with Jesus Christ. The best churches that are the healthiest that I have ever played at, which are these ones that I've mentioned, typically are not asking that on your first day. They might wait for you to ask a question after you have been graciously accepted into this world, and then maybe you wonder about bringing your family to the Christmas service, right? Like, I think that if you want to play in a church environment, find a church that isn't going to essentially dress you down and say, what do you believe on your first day? Find a church that feels cool. There's a lot of cool churches out there that probably honestly don't actually care in your heart of hearts what you believe. Because you know what? Staff at church have questions too. There's not a single worship leader that I have ever played with that is like 100% card-carrying, right-wing American Christian. They all are complex. They're all complex people, right? So typically, the churches just want somebody to show up on time, to behave themselves, to like conduct themselves in a way that's respectful in a green room full of people that have different ideologies and backgrounds and musical abilities, right? They want somebody that is going to be positive and hang out. I mean, you know, I have an odd duality. I have Christian tendencies and I have atheist tendencies. I went to a school where I had a linguistics professor tell me that atheism was more near true Christianity than American right-wing Christianity. He said, you know why? Because when you pass away, you leave space for the next thing to happen. That's true selflessness. My linguistics professor, my atheist linguistics professor at McAllister College said, do you want to know why I'm more Christian than you? And I said, yeah. He said, because when I pass away, I am creating space for something else to flourish. That is true selflessness. Not thinking how you're going to be uploaded into the place with streets paved of gold. That shit has stuck with me my entire life. You can rattle a lot of Christian cages with that one, FYI. That's maybe not the green room thing you want to lead with. That's maybe not the green room conversation you want to lead like on your first day at the mega church, right? But contrast that. So I was like a card-carrying atheist for a while. And then I met this whole other group of people that interacted with one another in like really lovely ways and seemed to care about me and care about what I had to say and what I thought that felt real. It didn't feel like they had to because they worked at a church. And I made some like lifelong friends and connections. And guess what? That drew me closer to this spiritual side than anything ever did in college when I was, you know, learning about Nietzsche and Baudrillard and how nothing exists and postmodernism and right. So there's something to be learned. So even if you're like me or you were like me and you thought, oh, I would never, you might be surprised at what you learn if you feel like you can be a participant in it with a glad heart. Like, don't do it if you think you're just going to hate it and you're kind of wanting to like secretly kind of like tear it down and kind of infiltrate. Like, I know people like that. They're like, oh yeah, man, I'm going to do it. And I'm, you know, and I, oh, I know. And they have this sort of like this idea that like, you know, they're going to ask really terrible, like not terrible, but like really provocative questions in the green room and make it really awkward. I mean, you know, whatever, do it, but maybe don't do that. I just think, here's what I want to say at the end of this. I think that both the cover band musician and the church musician are incredible, incredible people and incredible positions and incredible goals to shoot for. To do either of those things really well is not a simple task. It's not simple. You may think so, but it is not, I promise you. And you're going to meet so many people that will like, you'll be astonished Then, because you met someone at the church, they're going to ask you to play on this record. Or because you met someone at this cover band thing, they're going to want you to go on like a USO tour and play in Kuwait. Like, all those things happened for me. And they never would have happened had I just, like, been tunnel visioned in my, you know, rock, my original rock band forever. That's cool too. But I just want to tell you that, like, some of the best musicians, some of the best people I have ever met are from those two environments. And I get real pissed when people shit on those two scenes. It drives me crazy because it's not easy to do. Just like if someone's like, oh, the bass player from Coldplay, the bass player from U2, Try to hold down those Adam Clayton eighth notes pocketed with perfect time and lovely groove and vintage tone, and it's not easy. So before you slag it, try it. It's like, right? It's like to your kids, like, well, I know you're saying that you don't like pickled herring, but have you tried it? Look, I'm not saying the church music and cover music is pickled herring. It's the pickled herring of music. It's not. But people talk about it like it is sometimes. And it's a disservice. It's an injustice. Right? So, I have probably said some things that I'm going to regret later, but it's the things that I've said are true. I really, really have enjoyed doing this episode. Thanks a lot for listening. We're going to be back next week with another one. So thanks a lot, and we'll catch you in the next one. Take care, everybody.